Okay, so I understood this was supposed to be an informal talk with 5 slides. So of course I decided that introductory slides did not count, and then chose 6 slides from an hour-long talk, and have 3 additional topics for discussion at the end, should you care to hear more. So this is all about how you, the questions we'd like to know about baryons around galaxies, right? How you get gas into galaxies. We have a pretty good picture of that for the Milky Way, perhaps, right? Where we see these high-velocity clouds in the halo of the Milky Way coming in at estimated accretion rates of, you know, a few solar masses per year, perhaps. So plausibly, that's of the same order as the current star formation rate in the Milky Way disk. And we know a little bit about how you get gas out of galaxies, right? There's examples of these nearby starburst galaxies like M82, where in emission, okay, you can see gas going, oh, a few kiloparsecs off the plane, 4 or 5 kiloparsecs. In the case of M82, there's a cloud out here from the M81 intergroup medium that the wind is running into, and it lights up. So it shows that, you know, where the emission ends is not where the wind ends, okay? It just becomes invisible, because as the density drops, the emission measure drops very rapidly. And then, in fact, with studies of, like, galaxy quasar pairs, okay, the cool gas, the entrained material that you see here in the red colors, has been mapped around nearby galaxies out to distances of 60 to 100 kiloparsecs. Of course, when we do this mapping with background sight lines, there's some ambiguity as to whether the gas you're seeing is part of an outflow, okay, or whether it's infalling material or gas in hydrostatic equilibrium. And there's some recent evidence in a paper with that I was on with Nicolas Boucher, where we look at quasar galaxy pairs at different angles from the minor axis, okay, and there is some evidence that the winds kind of have an excess equivalent width that they add to this halo gas when you're looking along the minor axis, okay, in nearby galaxies. So the picture that is emerging is pretty compelling, I think, in terms of circulating metals and heavy elements, okay, through a circumgalactic medium. In spectra of the hot X-ray emitting gas in these winds, okay, we see that it's enhanced with metals relative to the ISM of the galaxies, that it's enhanced with alpha elements relative to iron. And then, of course, right, the amazing discovery that the intergalactic medium, at least at moderate overdensities in the Lyman alpha forest, is polluted with heavy elements, right, strongly suggests that these metals came out of galaxies. Okay, so the case for getting metals out of galaxies is pretty strong. And I think the issues, I mean, you see this presumably in the mass metallicity relationship for galaxies as well. And the question really is, you know, what fraction of the metals escape permanently and stay in the IGM, and what fraction are continually recycled? Okay, and I love this simulation by Suki Kawata and Michael Rauch, where you see the gas kind of going out, kind of perpendicular to these filaments, and then the gas out here, it falls back into a filament and comes back into the galaxy. Right? This is the picture I have in my head of the circumgalactic medium right now, that it's one of circulation. And, you know, what's a lot more uncertain than the metals right now is how much mass, right? This thing we'd really like to know is how much mass is circulating and whether this can, you know, basically keep the baryons out of stars and galaxies. That's not at all clear at the moment.
What's the scale of
the picture
respectively?
This one?
Radius? Yeah.
This is, this is 200 kiloparsecs proper.
That's approximately the radius of the galaxy.
Approximately, yeah.
So the circulation from the
scale of 100 kpc, yeah. And that's been measured both directly for mapping out metals, okay, and in the simulations. I mean, it's interesting in simulations, the scale of the circulation is pretty independent of galaxy mass and redshift for various. I'm not sure what the radius is.
That's aggressively, roughly a kilometer per second is a kiloparsec. Depends on, depends on omega, how it goes. So if you have 200 kiloparsec, but I have redshift 3, I have a pretty massive guy.
Yeah. Okay, so there's open questions about the amount of mass circulating. This is going to be difficult to get at soon with observations because of the multi-phase nature of these winds. Okay, what we can hope to probe in the short term is the gas that you see here in red and orange that's cool at 100 to 10,000 degrees Kelvin that's entrained in this hot coronal wind at 10 million degrees, which by and large we cannot trace beyond the local universe. Okay. So I'm going to talk mainly about this cold entrained gas, but you got to remember that this is always just a lower limit on how much stuff is out there. Now, of course, one of the interesting pictures, right, that's emerged is this whole idea of cold flows. And in that context, right, these high velocity clouds in the Milky Way are kind of a little bit that's left over at the present epoch from what were cold streams penetrating into galaxies, okay? In halos below 10 to 12 solar masses at higher redshifts. And of course, one thing we're all looking for is some sort of observational evidence that this is what the universe really does. Okay.
Are we certain that's the origin of high velocity clouds?
No.
Okay.
One picture.
Okay.
One way to link things up. So just one more picture, okay, about what this low ionization gas in a wind really is. And there's different physical origins for it. I mean, here's a picture where this is the ISM. This is a supershell expanding. It blows out along the minor axis of the galaxy, and the cool entrained gas is fragments, okay, of this shell. Here's a picture, okay, where a hot wind extends out along the minor axis of the galaxy, and the shear flow between that wind and the disk creates these vortices and these Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities, right, break off little bits of turbulent flow that are advected out in the wind. Okay, these are what we see in low ionization absorption. And yet a third picture, okay, of where this cool entrained material comes from. In this simulation, they started out with a realistic interstellar medium that had clouds in it, and some of these clouds just get advected out into the wind, so they were pre-existing. Okay, so there's at least three different origins, okay, for how you entrain the cool material that we're going to study in a hot flow. And the questions, right, are just how well that cool material traces, okay, the underlying hot flow. Okay, so we're going to use interstellar absorption, okay, from low ionization gas to trace outflows. And I'm going to talk first about some recent work, okay, that we've done at Redshift 1. And this counts as my first of the five slides, okay? So, you know, Redshift 1, right, it's pretty interesting epoch, right? Because the cosmic star formation rate is starting to really plummet. And we'd like to understand why, if we're going to understand what the baryons are doing. And, you know, between redshifts of 2 and 0, right, I mean, the star formation rate, right, at a fixed stellar mass, right, declines by like a factor of 20 or something. And this decrease, right, in star formation rate at a fixed stellar mass is reminiscent, right, at least roughly in the power law of the scaling, with how the accretion rate onto halos is changing with redshift. So this similarity, right, has suggested models that several groups have looked at, where the star formation rate in galaxies at this epoch is regulated not by internal processes about clouds in the ISM, but by the rate of cosmological cold inflowing gas, okay, with a slight adjustment for kind of what goes out in the outflows. Now, in some ways, I think you could claim this model is very finely tuned because there's an upper mass limit on the halos where this operates, about 10 to the 12 solar masses. The idea being that in more massive halos, the cold flows don't survive into the galaxy if they're shocked. And to make these models fit data, okay, the Tully-Fisher relation and the galaxy mass function and things like this, you have to have a quenching mass, okay, of a halo mass of about 10 to the 11, below which some sort of hypothesized feedback mechanism or something shuts off star formation in your halos.
So the gas stays there but accumulates as more, doesn't cool.
Critical thing for their model is it doesn't form stars.
Right? So they store it.
And it's left to the imagination of how that works, right? But this leaves us really only a decade, right, in halo mass, where this equilibrium is supposed to be set up. So it's interesting, right, to compare kind of these halo masses to the masses of the galaxies we were able to take spectra of. Okay, so these come from the Deep 2 survey, and our redshift range is 0.5 roughly, okay, to about 1.4. So the color coding here is the low, medium, and high redshift part of that sample. And you can see them here in a color mass diagram. So like the red sequence is up here. So these are all normal star-forming galaxies for the most part. And I show a histogram here on the bottom, okay, of their stellar masses. So these range from about 9.5 to 11.6 or something. And if you look at abundance matching results, okay, and try to match this stellar mass range into halo mass at redshift 1, okay, these are halos about 10 to the 11.25, 10 to the 14.2, and then slightly less on the low end and more on the high end, okay, at Z of 0.5. So, right, what this says, right, is this lower mass cutoff, okay, is just about a factor of 3 down here below where our lowest mass galaxies are. So we don't really probe this transition well, but our lower mass galaxies are only a factor of few, not order of magnitude, away from that transition. But this transition at a halo mass of 10 to the 12, interestingly, right, basically lies right in the middle of our sample in terms of stellar mass. So maybe these things, on average, still have some cold flows in them, and maybe this part of the sample wouldn't. Okay, so it would be interesting if we saw any transition in the outflow properties. Okay, now I should say one advantage, right, of doing our work in Deep 2 is that all we have to do is look at the properties of the winds. Right, there's been so much work done on the Deep 2 field that things like the rest frame colors and absolute magnitudes have been measured. Okay, stellar masses have been measured from SED fitting, both optical and infrared photometry. And then for one of the four Deep 2 fields, about a quarter of our sample, there's galaxy UV photometry from which pretty robust extinction-corrected star formation rates have been obtained. Okay. And then I'll point out that there's been work on outflows previously at this redshift, but it pretty much all comes from composite spectra. Okay, so one of the neat things here is we can see not just what the average spectrum does, but how much variation there is, okay, about that. Okay. So I went to Keck, okay, with my prime collaborators in this were Alice Shapley and Allison Coyle. And over a period of several years, we took about 200 really deep spectra, okay, of Z of 1-ish galaxies. And these are mainly with multi-slit mask because to get a good spectrum, we're talking about 8 hours per galaxy kind of thing if you want to see these absorption lines. And no, our individual spectra don't look quite this good on average. This is a stack, okay, of we observed at two different spectral resolutions. That's all that's compared here. But this is the rest frame near UV spectrum that we're probing. We had to get new spectra, okay, rather than use Deep 2 survey spectra, because the observed wavelength of these at redshift 1 is in basically the far blue part of the spectrum. Okay, so we're using bluer spectra than the survey spectra. And you can see in blue here, I've marked some of the resonant absorption lines. Okay, these are iron 2 lines. There's two really weak lines out here. These are important because they're not saturated. And then there's a triplet of lines here. Here's a doublet of iron 2 lines. Here's the famous magnesium 2 doublet that everyone observes in the IGM. And there's a magnesium 1 line out here. Okay. So note that what resonant absorption lines are accessible to you, okay, depends on what redshift you're looking at. So in this redshift range of, you know, 0.3 to kind of 2, you get these near UV lines. We've kind of cross-correlated these with the sodium 1 work that's been done at redshift 0, okay, in a 2009 paper with Nicholas Boucher, and they largely show the same kinematics. And then in the future, for the higher redshift part of our sample, okay, we'll be trying to directly link, do you measure the same thing, these near UV lines, as you do at far UV lines? And this is an important link, okay, to connect up to the work on winds at Z of 3. Okay, but let me show you a few neat things about this part of the spectrum. Okay, you'll notice some emission lines here that I've marked in red. Okay. And they're surprised us the first time we saw them. It's a pretty neat atomic physics here. Okay, if we start over with this guy, say in iron, let's start with magnesium. Okay. So on magnesium, right, there's just absorption lines, there's no emission lines. In magnesium too, if you drew a Grotrian diagram, okay, energy levels here, the ground state is a singlet, and you have absorption in the 2803 line, in the 2796 line, and every absorption, okay, is followed by an emission of a photon at the same wavelength, right? We call this scattering. It's like Lyman alpha does. And the mystery here, right, is if these are absorption lines from an outflowing wind, we should be seeing emission, right, from the backside too. And in fact, in some individual spectra, we do. And clearly, the fact that it's not there in the mean spectrum, okay, shows that in some galaxies that emission is not making it out, probably due to dust grains, okay? Or it could be an orientation effect. We'll talk about a little bit later. Okay, but iron too is special because the ground state is not a singlet. So let's just look at one multiplet first of iron too. Okay, so in the ground state, there's fine structure, okay, in the different J levels, like J of 9 halves, 7 halves, 5 halves, 3 halves, 1/2. Okay, and then up here to an excited level. Okay. So what happens is, say you have absorption in the 2600 line. Sometimes there'll be a photon re-emitted in 2600. But J can change by 0, plus 1, or minus 1. So sometimes your decay will be the emission of a shorter wavelength photon, okay, process we call fluorescence. And that's exactly what's happening, okay, with these lines coming out here. And then there's cases with, this is UV1, the other multiplets, UV2 and UV3, where there's fluorescent emission coming out here. And these different iron 2 lines, some of the lines, okay, are, you know, have a high probability for fluorescing, which means that the absorption troughs are pretty clean. They're not filled in with emission in the resonant transition. There's other multiplets, okay, where in the upper state, if the minimum level here is J of 11 halves, it acts like a resonant transition, because after it goes up, right, it can't come down to J of 7 halves, that would be delta J of 2, so it essentially behaves like magnesium 2. Okay, and that's what this guy should do. So this guy scatters, this guy fluoresces, here's the fluorescence coming out. There's more fluorescence, okay, from the other ones. And we'll see why some of these details are important in a bit. Okay, so the other thing I should have said over here, in looking at the strengths of these lines, okay, if we just measure the area of an absorption trough, right, we measure the area of this trough by saying what's the equivalent width of the continuum that has the same level. Okay, back to yesterday. Too bad, Frank. This was specifically for Frank. Hopefully he's listening online. This equivalent width, okay, for an optically thin line, okay, will grow with the column density. It'll tell us about the amount of material on the line of sight. But for an optically thick line, okay, this width grows with what we call B, the Doppler parameter, the velocity spread, the stuff along the sight line. So both of these things, right, could be related to an outflowing wind, more velocity spread, more column. So what we see here, okay, if we make stacks of the spectra, in this case, by stellar mass, okay? Just taking the 208 spectra, divide them into the high, middle, and low stellar mass quartiles, you can see huge differences in what the magnesium 2 lines look like, okay? In the high mass case, right, we've got the deepest trough here, and then as you go down in stellar mass, the troughs become shallower. Now, there's a number of reasons, right, that the troughs could become weaker, okay? You could have a smaller velocity spread. Take a look here, okay? If you look at kind of where the blue wing of this line profile meets the continuum, within the error bars, they're all at the same number here, okay? They're consistent. There could be more interstellar absorption in addition to the outflowing wind. Well, that may be the case a little bit, because if you look over here on the red side of the profile that's near the galaxy velocity, you know, there's a little less absorption in the low mass case. There could be, in the high mass case, you could have a contribution to these lines from stellar absorption lines. Okay. If you go look at stellar models, though, what you'll see is that in an early type galaxy spectrum, you will have absorption from alkali metals, in fact, but it'll be a very broad, shallow line. But in a continuously star-forming galaxy, basically the equivalent widths contribution from the stars should be negligible, okay, in these galaxies. So it's probably not that. So I claim that a lot of the difference in these equivalent widths is actually due to this, what I call emission filling, okay, that this resonance emission is filling up part of the absorption trough. And you can see that partly here in the low stellar mass case, right, you can see a bit of emission here up above the continuum, peaking up. More evidence for that, okay, is that this member of the doublet has an oscillator strength that's twice that of this member. So in the optically thin limit, this trough should always be twice as strong as this one. And in fact, you can see as you go up here, this one gets weaker compared to this one. And intrinsically, the intrinsic absorption trough just cannot do that. It's being filled in, okay, by more emission in this case. You kind of get the same picture when you look at the iron lines. Okay, this is that 2382 line that I said it scatters like magnesium 2 does. And you see the same effect that it's getting, this 2600 and 2382 scatters. They're filling in here quite a bit. Whereas this 2587 line and this 2374 line, okay, that fluoresce most of the time and shouldn't be very affected by emission filling, their equivalent widths are actually changing less. Okay. And none of them are changing nearly as much as the magnesium. So what seems to be changing here is how much scattered emission there is, as opposed to claiming that the column density of magnesium or the velocity spread is changing a whole lot with mass. So the same trend, okay, that you see with mass, you see with luminosity, in the sense that as you go to brighter objects, the lines are deeper. As you go to fainter objects, there's more emission filling. And then since mass, luminosity, color are all correlated, right, it's not too surprising you see the same trend with color, that you see larger equivalent widths in redder galaxies, okay, and smaller equivalent widths in bluest galaxies. Then down here, okay, we take the subsample of about 50 galaxies that we have star formation rates for, and you can see, okay, now something a little bit different here. In the high star formation rate galaxies, you see stronger lines. That could perhaps be due to larger velocities, but if you take the star formation rates, normalize by the amount of stellar mass, okay, to get specific star formation rates, you can see that the low specific star formation rate wins here in terms of the line strength. So it's saying, okay, the lines get stronger with star formation rate, they get stronger with stellar mass, but stellar mass wins when you compare the two.
What do you define as high star formation
rate? Split the sample in two, so the median there is around 10-15 solar masses per year.
10-15.
The median somewhere in the 10 to 15 range. Yeah. So in all of these composites, okay, when you do a joint fit to this series of iron two lines, or throwing out the ones that are most affected by the emission filling, okay, you'll get a net blue shift in all of these cases, but it's, you know, it's about minus 30 kilometers per second, you know, plus or minus 10 or something. It's a piddly little outflow, okay, in the composite sense. If you take all the individual spectra, the 208, okay, and you pick out the 30 or so with the most significant iron two Doppler shifts and add them together, and pick out the 10 or so with the most significant red shifts of the iron two lines and add them together, okay, you get this. And now you can see here the significant blue shift of these iron two outflow galaxies. The blue shift here is about 120, okay, kilometers per second. And the red shift for the three sigma inflows is a little under, plus 100 kilometers per second.
So what do you use as systemic velocity to align?
Yeah, great question. So I didn't show it here, but we know systemic really well. So if we go out here another 1,000 angstroms, okay, due to the fact that LRES is a double channel spectrograph, in the red part of the spectrum, we record the oxygen 2, okay, emission doublet. We resolve it, okay, for all the galaxies. And for the lower redshift ones, we get the oxygen 3 lines as well. So our systemic redshifts are very well determined.
Yeah. So why do those lines, why do those lines match so accurately systemic velocities? They cannot be like from an H2 region or somewhere that it's in some strange velocity.
Right. So we're using the nebular lines, okay, to define systemic here. So what we're really measuring is what's the velocity of interstellar absorption compared to interstellar emission. Okay. So the premise, right, is that the interstellar emission scales as the density squared. It's tracing the densest regions and therefore a more central part of the galaxy than the absorption, which is basically the integral of the density along the line of sight. Now, the point Tommaso's brought up, though, is very relevant, right, in the sense that in one of these spiral galaxies, particularly at the low redshift part of the sample, you could have an extended object along the slit and have an H2 region off on one side, and the rotation of the galaxy could, you know, bias you. So for the quarter of the sample that's in the deep two, there is HST imaging, and we've looked at those images, and you know, we've kind of gone through and found what fraction of the sample is there possibly contamination, and it's small. And about the maximum error you can make is about 30 or 40 kilometers per second.
Yeah. You're capturing the overall.
You can pick out individual objects, okay, where there is some rotation curve, you know, along your slit. But in these cases, right, what you see is you've got the slit. And then in the spectrum, you know, you see 202 lines, right, that look like this, and you pick this for zero. We don't see cases, you know, where there's just a blob out here. So it looks pretty good. But for, you know, it's one of those things where it's clearly fine in the mean for any one individual object, which we'll come back and talk to for some of the inflow objects where there's only a handful that show strong inflows. You got to look very carefully to make sure you've not made a mistake. Okay. So let's move from composite spectra, okay, where we've seen some general trends that these lines get stronger at high stellar mass, higher luminosity, redder objects, to what we can learn from individual spectra. And here, okay, on the left, I'm just showing how do we define the Doppler shift. Well, we've got like 7 transitions from iron two. So we do a joint fit to the 5 of those transitions, okay, that fluoresce mainly, so that we're not affected by the emission filling. And this shows examples of a couple of the outflow galaxies. Okay, you can see here the blue is the fit. The red line shows you systemic velocity. There's no question here that this trough is blue shifted. And you can see that the other iron lines basically give a consistent blue shift. This is the magnesium 2 doublet for the same galaxy. You can see the red line here is its systemic. often the systemic velocity matches the magnesium 2 emission well, and you see these blue shifted absorption troughs. Okay, but you can see there's a lot of variety in the magnesium 2, right? Like here it's completely filled in, and then you see the trough here. Okay, but the typical velocities here, right, they're, you know, the average blue shift of the far UV lines in like Lyman Brake galaxy spectra is about 200 kilometers per second, okay? And we see examples similar to that, although those are the extremes. A lot of them are more like minus 100 kilometers per second in iron 2. Okay? And, you know, out of 200, right, it's roughly a third or something where when you measure the iron 2 Doppler shift at the 3 sigma certainty level, right, you can actually say this is a definitive blue shift, right? A lot of them come out to be minus 40 plus or minus 30 kilometers per second, and, you know, that's consistent with being zero. So what do you do, right? You've got like these 208 spectra, and what you really wanted to know was like what fraction of the galaxies have outflows and how fast are those outflows. But, you know, you're only finding a third or less of your sample where there's a definitive blue shift. How do you put all the information, okay, together? So what we do, okay, is for each galaxy, we've measured, you know, our best guess at what the Doppler shift is, and we have an error distribution, okay? So call this the iron 2 Doppler shift, V1. So for some particular galaxy, right, maybe our error distribution looks like this, where we've measured minus 100 kilometers per second. We fit this error distribution with a Gaussian, okay, the errors are roughly normally distributed, and we use this width, okay? So then we can say, well, what do you mean? What's the odds that this galaxy has an outflow? How do you want to define an outflow? Choose where you want to set your threshold criteria. You could say, well, anything bluer than, you know, 40 kilometers per second, call that an outflow. Call this V-crit, okay? Then I look at this error distribution and I say, there's a very high probability that this galaxy has an outflow that's faster than 40 kilometers per second. But I could have said, well, I only want to count things that are higher than 200 kilometers per second, because at least then V outflow is similar to the circular speed in the galaxy or something. So, right, then there's a small probability for this particular galaxy that it has an outflow that high. But in this way, right, I can add up the total probability of having an outflow. I can add up over the whole sample of galaxies the chance that each particular galaxy, right, has a V less than some P crit and divide by the galaxies. And in that way, I can use both the high quality data and the low quality data, kind of all adds up. Okay, so look at just this curve first. This is for outflows, and the other curve is for inflows, V greater than some number. And this shows you, okay, that whereas from the composite spectra, you might have thought, and it has been claimed, that outflows are ubiquitous at this redshift, this is not at all a case, okay? At minus 200 kilometers per second, right, there's about 5% of these normal star-forming galaxies that have an outflow that fast. Okay, at 100 kilometers per second, about 1 out of 5 galaxies shows that much of a Doppler shift. Okay, and just if you want to say, well, if you're going to take every galaxy and divide it into inflow or outflow, well, okay, there are more outflows than inflows, about 65%. And you can see the number of really significant inflows, okay, like gas coming in at velocities higher than 100 kilometers per second is also small, okay, less than 10%. So we can then look, okay, and say, well, if this outflow fraction is completely independent of galaxy properties, you know, one would come to the conclusion that the solid angle, maybe, of the outflow, right, is not 4 pi star radians, but is, you know, a quarter of that or half of that, or in this case, right, 20% of that. That 20% of the time, we're looking down the cone of the outflow, we see an outflow. The other times we don't. But maybe, right, maybe there's a special 20% of the galaxies that have this. Maybe these are the low stellar mass galaxies, or the high star formation rate galaxies, or the bluest galaxies. Okay? So we basically repeat this exercise of calculating the outflow probability, but we do it for galaxies by different mass tertiles, luminosity tertiles, and so forth. And I think this is number 5 of my 6 slides now. So first, okay, look at these iron 2 velocities, okay, that we've been talking about. This is versus redshift, okay? So this is the threshold for defining an outflow, fraction of galaxies that have an outflow by that definition. The blue curve shows you the high redshift tertile, so this is basically 1 to 1.4. The middle is around 1, and low Z's down around 0.5. I should have said that the error bars here, okay, what we did was just do this exercise and say, okay, for a given V crit, you know, how many do we get 0, you know, is for the number of galaxies that have outflows, calculate the probability, okay, from the sample, and then change that, right, into a cumulative probability, add them up, and then find, right, the limits, right, that correspond basically to the 68% confidence interval. So these are 1 sigma error bars along the curve, okay, but they're not completely independent points because the same data points go into each point. So you can see here, right, I mean, at high redshift, over a lot of this range, the high redshift curve lies a little bit higher, but I would say the curves are really pretty similar. I wouldn't make much of those differences because, you know, the error bars clearly overlap there. If we sort the galaxies by mass, okay, blue is high mass, red is low mass, and again, I ignore things near zero, okay, because our errors in systemic velocity are like 20 or 30 kilometers per second. So out here in the outflow regime, right, for high velocity outflows, they're all identical. Makes no difference what your stellar mass is. But now if we go to star formation rate, okay, we start to see some differences, right? The higher star formation rate galaxies are more likely to show an outflow than are the lower star formation rate galaxies. And probably the most significant result here in terms of the error bar, the place where the outflows are really suppressed are in the things with low specific star formation rates.
How about inflow? Get more inflow when you have more star formation, or more star formation than more inflow?
Nope, it's independent.
That seems to go against this last thing, right?
Well, the galaxies that show inflow seem to be completely independent of any galaxy parameter. So I will conclude if I guess because of that question, I can go on to the inflow part of the talk.
This is a time scale I don't know.
Well, where I was going to go on that was that if it's just an orientation effect, then you don't expect any trend with. If all the galaxies have inflows, but the covering factor is 10%, then only 1 in 10 will show it. So one interesting thing about these trends, okay, is that here we talked about measuring the Doppler shift of iron 2. You know, we wanted to measure some kind of velocity from the magnesium profiles because, you know, they're the strongest line, right? You can see them the best. But the centroid of this line doesn't tell you anything because of the emission filling. Perhaps the emission can be used in some way if you had that for all the galaxies. So what we did was say, well, this blue wing, okay, of the emission profile should not be affected much by the scattered emission, okay, because it's going to fill in mainly around zero, just because out in the if velocity is increasing with radius, you're not going to have much scattering out at the largest distances. So we did go through and just ran a little Monte Carlo simulation to resample all the spectra 1,000 times and measure basically where the spectra met the continuum. Okay, we call this our magnesium 2 Vmax measurement. We did the same exercise with that, correlating with galaxy parameters. This is the iron 2, okay, this is the magnesium 2 Vmax. And, you know, the trend with stellar mass here is still not huge, but it's much more significant than anything here of the iron 2. So the take-home message from this is just that the Vmax of the blue wing and the Doppler shift of the iron 2 do not appear to depend on the same galaxy properties. Okay. This Vmax is not as sensitive to star formation rate as the iron 2 Doppler shift is. One possibility is that we're just being influenced here by some broad wings from stellar absorption. Okay, and this is coming in preferentially in the higher mass galaxies, which on average are redder. But we've done some tests and it wasn't clear to us that that's the explanation either. This is a diagram that I like, but no one else ever has, so if you don't understand it, don't worry, I'll move on quickly. What this is just meant to show you, I mean, it's plotting two odd quantities against each other, the iron 2 Doppler shift, okay, and this Vmax for magnesium 2. And it's saying, ignore this part of the diagram, because when Vmax is low, it's unresolved, and we haven't measured a thing over here. And what it's meant to show you, okay, is that when iron 1 is blue shifted, okay, all these points up here, you very often see a high Vmax value, but that you can also see these high Vmax wings, okay, when iron 2 is red shifted. Size of the circle tells you something about the signal to noise ratio. So if the circle's big, you should trust it more. The error bar is smaller. And if it's colored in, okay, that means that the iron 2 Doppler shift, okay, is very secure. It's better than 3 sigma. That there's no doubt that there's an iron 2 outflow here, and there's no doubt that there's an iron 2 inflow here. Okay. Main point here being that, you know, so these are the only significant inflows in red here, a small number of objects that we're going to talk about in a minute. But, you know, many of these inflow objects have extended have magnesium 2 absorption at high blue shifts, is what I'm trying to say. So just because you have a net inflow in terms of what's the velocity where most of the absorption equivalent width is, doesn't mean you may not have outflowing gas at velocities right here of 600 kilometers per second. So it is possible, I think, to see inflows and outflows in the same spectrum. Before I go past my 6 slides into inflows, maybe I should ask if there's any questions or discussion.
Yeah, is this not some sort of like, how should we interpret that? Is it like, is it the launching velocity of the wind? Is it, I mean, what is the physical?
Naively, level 1 from just looking at the spectrum, you should say, well, there's outflowing gas at least this velocity. Okay. In a 2009 paper with Nicholas Boucher, we had some beautiful magnesium 2 spectra that were high resolution, okay, of some galaxies at redshift 0.3. So we were able to take the absorption profile in the two members of the doublet, okay, and basically do the doublet ratio as a function of velocity. And this told us something, we think, about where the gas is along, where the high velocity gas is along the line of sight. Okay, so we wanted to distinguish between the highest velocity gas at the launching mechanism and the flow decelerates, or is the highest velocity gas at the largest distance. Okay, and what we found by comparing the doublet ratio was that the covering fraction of the gas got lower with increasing velocity. So we do this by showing that the depth of the absorption trough was the same in both lines at high velocity. Okay, so the lines were optically thick. Hence, the only reason they weren't black is because the clouds don't completely cover the continuum source. And that covering factor got lower at higher velocity. Then the geometrical picture, if you're still following the links here, right, is that in any sort of spherical flow, as it expands, the covering factor goes down. So you expect the lower covering factor gas to be at larger radii. This provides evidence that in the six objects that we looked at, the higher velocity gas is at larger distances from the starburst. It's not a lot, but it's the little bit that we know. Yeah.
What's the sort of opening angle of these flows? Are they mostly spherical, or are there going to be some flows which are more or less in the sky planes, which accounts for some of the ones where you don't?
Yeah. So I would love for an HST TAC to let us take high resolution images of all of these, okay, so that we could really look at which ones were inclined and which ones were face on and test this in a reasonable way, okay? But, you know, I would look at these plots and I would say, you know, for the most part here, you know, there's not much correlation with mass. There's a little bit of correlation with star formation rate, but even that, right, is it's factors of two at most here. So, you know, if you're roughly equal to see a Doppler a blue shift in any of these blue cloud galaxies, right, to me that, you know, one interpretation of that to me is that for the fast part of the outflow, right, the opening angle's about 5% of 4 pi, and at 100 kilometers per second, you're at about 20% of 4 pi. And, you know, you can change that into angles, and it's going to be interesting, I think, when that kind of meets the quasar probing galaxy sightline studies to see if those two numbers converge. Those sorts of studies suggest kind of the half opening angle is about 45 degrees. But.
So presumably it looks like M82, sort of like that.
Yeah. Yeah, in these objects. We could come back and talk about local ULURGs and argue that it looks nothing like M82, but may look like SINS galaxies at Z of 2, but that might be a better story for another day. Okay, so final word about outflows here before we go to inflows. This is star formation rate sequence. Okay, star formation rate plotted against stellar mass, low redshift, intermediate redshift, high redshift. The red line is a fit, not to the data shown here, to all deep two data, okay, that show the star formation sequence at these redshifts, and that the specific star formation rate declines with increasing stellar mass. And, you know, this relation, right, is what evolves fairly strongly with redshift, which is why I've broken it into three panels. What I've shown here, right, is for the individual galaxies, I've highlighted the ones in blue, solid, with very significant iron 2 outflows, and with crosses, moderately significant iron 2 outflows. Perhaps, right, there's some trend there for see the more significant outflows in the things that have slightly higher than average specific star formation rate. But we need larger number of statistics here to see how robust that is. But there's a bit of a trend there. Okay, in contrast, okay, if we go to the significant iron 2 redshifts now, they're a scatter in that star formation diagram. This is where they lie in the color magnitude diagram and the color mass diagram. Okay, so we see these inflows basically at all luminosities and over the full mass range. Let me go into the details to convince you that we really have inflows. Okay, so these are different objects in different columns. So six examples here. The top line shows you where the redshift comes from. Right, we have to establish that systemic redshift. So These are the oxygen 2 doublets here. Okay. And there's just no question, right, that the emission is, well, by definition, okay, this is defining systemic velocity. Carbon 2 here is a nebular emission line that has actually, you can see from these vertical lines, it has several different fine structure lines kind of near the same wavelength. That's just kind of a consistency check on our redshift, but the line's not really strong enough to say much. So here we have, okay, different iron transitions, and then magnesium down at the bottom. And you can see here the fit in blue to the iron. This shows a two-component fit. Let's not worry about those at the moment. But in the one-component fits here, okay, you can see, I mean, some of these redshifts aren't large, but it's pretty definitively redshifted. In most of the cases where we pick these galaxies out because of their iron 2 redshift, when you look at magnesium, okay, you also see that the absorption is redshifted. In this one, it's not. It's at systemic. Okay, so the typical redshifts here are kind of 100 to 200 kilometers per second. We find this in about 5% of the galaxies. If we were to go out to the kind of the red wing of the magnesium and say, what's the very highest velocity where you see any inflow, it's in this range. So the weird thing here, right, if you thought, well, this fraction is, you know, matches perfectly, right, what simulations say the covering factor of cold flows should be, it matches it too perfectly, really, given the uncertainties in measuring these things and the uncertainties in the simulation. But it does, you know, raise that question. Could these redshifts be places where, you know, we're looking right down a filament of material falling into these galaxies? The big problem here, okay, or the surprise, if that is the correct interpretation, is that we're measuring this inflow in metal lines, okay? And in these simulations, right, the cold flows coming in are unenriched gas. So one possibility is that these are not cosmological flows, that this is some sort of tidal debris, you know, that's infalling and that we've picked out mergers here preferentially. Again, we'd like that HST imaging. Another possibility is that the models aren't really accurate yet in the sense that most of the models for cosmological inflows don't really incorporate feedback processes, again, that are circulating these metals through the halo. And like I showed in that first picture from Kavata and Rauch, maybe those incoming filaments are polluted a bit with metals, okay, from the outflows.
It also looks like it looks like these simulations from weathers or things and also that you actually kicks a low angle momentum material out by feedback processes, and that's coming back in a pitched manner. So probably not natural cold flows like filaments.
But it's more like infalling wind, but not
feedback loops.
Mm-hmm. Feedback loops, yeah. You're a programmer, aren't you?
I'm also wondering.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's really cold flows, then you should see an effect with redshift. Mm-hmm. Cold flow, you're only getting the high redshift universe. And the redshift 1 would already be where you more go into the accretion mode of hot gas.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you can see here from low to high, I mean, there's no change in the fraction.
Argue against that.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there's a little more information we were able to pull out of this. And that was trying to look at the environment of these galaxies a little bit. Okay, just kind of look at what was there along the slit. In this spectrum, this is the oxygen 2 emission, okay, that I was talking about. We were going back and looking at all of these to check to make sure our systemic velocity was very accurate and look for rotation and these things. And we saw this little blob of emission, okay, off here to the side. And we looked over here in the image, this doesn't show up very well, but there's like a little bump of continuum over here. So it's as if there's a little extended piece of the disk in this galaxy, or a little satellite galaxy there. Okay, this is offset about 12 kiloparsecs, I think, from the center of the galaxy. And okay, this is identified as a redshift on a spectrum that's extracted right here. And what's interesting is the redshift of this emission matches to within 20 kilometers per second, okay, the redshift of the iron 2 absorption seen down the barrel here. So it says, right, it says there's gas flowing in to the middle here at a velocity that matches the either infall or rotation velocity of this little galaxy off to the side. Probably wouldn't have thought too much about that. But then we check this galaxy. In this case, we're looking at the 035007 line. See a little bit of a rotation curve here. And off to the side, saw emission from another little galaxy. We went to the image, okay? So here's our slit. This is a foreground object. And our slit doesn't quite go through this nearby galaxy, but it passes by the side of it. And it's apparently at the same redshift, okay, as this little galaxy. And what's again interesting is the redshift of this galaxy relative to this one matches the redshift of the iron 2 that's seen falling in to this galaxy. So what this does tell us, I think, from these two examples, is that whatever this gas is that's falling into the galaxy, it is spatially extended. Okay, the separation here is about 30 kiloparsecs. So it's not just whether it's a stream from feedback, whether it's a stream from an interaction, or a stream from a cold flow. It's extended over tens of kiloparsecs, it seems like. Of all the inflows, these are the only other two, okay, where the emission was at all extended. And you can see there's pretty good rotation curves in both of them. Whether it means anything, I don't know, but the redshifted part of these disks is at a similar velocity to the redshift of the iron 2 absorption down the barrel. And that's maybe a good place to stop and have discussion.
Do you expect also to have like stuff engulfed in them? Like, are also like things like the high velocity clouds or small satellites, things coming in those directions as well?
I think so. I mean, that's my understanding, that you're going to bring in
stuff with.
You're bringing in stuff with them. Right. So when you see a little galaxy, you know, near it, is it tracing a cold filament that's coming in, or is it a sign that this is a merger? I don't think you can distinguish between those two.
Is this way of looking for little things could be a way to.
Yeah. I mean, we need to be able to do this in some systematic way to look and see, but. Yeah. We don't.
What's the minimum mentalist that you think you need in your inflows?
It works back the other way, right? In the sense that I can give you an estimate of what the column in iron 2 is. And then the question is how much gas is there depends on what you think the metallicity is. So if you think the metallicity is solar, okay, let's say that gives us a lower limit on the hydrogen column, right? And if we make the metallicity lower than that, we'll infer even more hydrogen. That'll give numbers of, you know, 10 to the 18 to 10 to the 19 for the hydrogen column for solar. And then you go up
from there. I guess one way to tell Payne's question is, if this gas were pristine or close to pristine, you need like enormous amounts of gas to give rise to the absorption lines you see. I mean, for plausible ranges of the amount of gas you may be expecting to see, you can tell if this is pristine or how much pre-enrichment there is, or how much feedback loop there is.
So I guess I have to look closer. I know in some of the papers on the cold flows, they basically break it down so that the covering factor is at different column densities, right? I mean, there's some column density gradient in these filaments. And I could maybe go back and look at, to get a covering factor of 5%, what column is that? And you could try to answer this question that way.
It doesn't have to be completely pristine, right? I mean, ICM is about 10% solar. IGM is between 1 to 0.1% solar. And then if it's somewhere in between, is it possible to...
Yeah, I mean, I think the numbers you're going to come up with are something more like 10% solar or, kind of 1 to 10% solar, I think you're going to come up with at least. But
maybe 10% solar is not crazy.
And I think it's also, right, I mean, it becomes a question of semantics when you see these little galaxies associated at the same velocity, whether what's gas being brought in by a merger and what's gas being brought in by a cold flow. Especially, at redshifts of kind of a half to one, that may be where this paradigm is kind of transitioning from one regime to the other. Just one more slide to wow you about the future, which is just that occasionally this emission that we see in magnesium 2, if you smooth it and look carefully, is actually spatially extended. And you can see that the emission in magnesium 2 here, extends over a couple arc seconds, it's almost 30 kiloparsecs. This is the spatial extent of the oxygen 2 emission, the nebular emission. And you can see that this scattered emission, right, it's like at the same velocity all along the slit, whereas the O2 shows a rotation curve. This emission that's filling in the troughs is very much from the halo of the galaxy. It does not have the kinematics nor the same spatial superposition as the disk. So out of a sample of 200 galaxies, there's one, possibly two, where we have the sensitivity to see this. But as you move on into the TMT error, there will be beautiful things you can map out at these redshifts.